really appreciate the opportunity to come visit the Perimeter Institute and actually find out a little bit about it. And you got a lovely place because your hockey stick is a player. I want to tell you today about a numerical approach to QCD. And it's actually a very interesting topic in the last few years because of some pretty significant breakthroughs that are allowing us to get truly high precision results out of these simulations and actually compare them to real life experiment. And I'd like to tell you about those breakthroughs. They're just in the last 3, 4, 5 years. And in order to tell you about them, though, I need to start with a little bit of a history of strong interaction physics just to set the stage. And so this will be a very short, probably not fairly accurate history, but it's sort of the way I remember it. I came into this history on the second slide myself. So the modern theory of strong interactions began in the 1960s when people introduced the idea of quarks. And the model was, of course, that protons were made up of 2 U quarks and a D quark. The quarks might have different colors. Neutron was 2 D quarks and a U quark. And that actually is just about the entire content of the model. It was not a terribly sophisticated model. It was introduced in order to help people understand some of the patterns they were observing in strongly interacting particles like protons and neutrons and mesons. But it was far from a complete theory of anything. And indeed, in the 60s, a lot of people felt that quarks weren't real. They were felt by some people to be a device to help theorists like me, who aren't very good at group theory, just deal with the group theory, for example. And but by the end of the 60s and early 70s, experiments began to show that protons actually were made of little particles. And people decided in pretty short order that they were quarks. And by the middle of the 1970s, we actually had a theory that not only had the constituents, but also had a theory of interactions for these quarks. And those interactions involved quarks, like the U quark and the D quark, exchanging gluons. This theory was explicitly designed to be like quantum electrodynamics, incredibly successful, even already by that time, incredibly successful quantum version of classical electrodynamics. And that meant it was a gauge theory. So gluon is kind of analogous to a photon. And with this, one had, for the first time, a complete theory of strong interaction physics. It was complete and like QED, except in two ways. One is that the theory, unlike QED, is nonlinear. What that meant was that Maxwell's equations, for example, the classical Maxwell's equations, had E and B fields raised, squared and cubed. It wasn't just linear. What that meant at the quantum level was that gluons could actually interact with themselves. Gluons carried the analog of electric charge, the QCD charge. So this carrier of the force could itself interact with itself, and so it was nonlinear. The other big difference was that the charge, the QCD charge of quarks, and even more so of gluons, was big. And that's a big difference from quantum electrodynamics. It meant that we actually, back in the 70s, couldn't solve QCD because the only generic technology for solving quantum field theories back then was perturbation theory. It relied upon expansions and powers of that charge. And so I can remember when this theory was, I was a graduate student when this theory was first named and promulgated. And I can remember people giving talks about it and observing that you couldn't solve it. And being somewhat puzzled about what the big deal was, because it seemed that QCD was adding nothing to the actual understanding of proton structure. You could write down a Hamiltonian, but you couldn't diagonalize it. And as a beginning graduate student, I can remember wondering, is this theory useless? Of course, I was just a graduate student, and I was missing, not for long, I might add, but briefly missing a key ingredient, which was asymptotic freedom. And in fact, asymptotic freedom, which just won a Nobel Prize not so long ago, asymptotic freedom was the property that really made QCD the key theory at that time, the one that everyone focused on. What asymptotic freedom is, or what was discovered, was that the actual charge that a quark has is through the nonlinearities and quantum effects in the theory, is actually, the effective charge is actually dependent upon the momentum transfer in the process. So if you have two quarks colliding with some momentum exchange Q, exchanging a gluon, the actual size of the strength of the interaction, the strength of the charge, is Q dependent, and that charge actually goes to zero as Q goes to infinity. So for very large momentum transfers, the charge actually is small enough that you can use perturbation theory, and you can solve the theory using Feynman diagrams and all the same technology we use for QCD. And so you would solve for the high energy or short distance processes, you could actually analyze them by doing expansions in powers of the QCD fine structure constant, this g squared over 4 pi. But one that actually depended on the momentum transfer that you were looking at. The bigger Q was, the smaller this parameter was, and the better perturbation theory was. This was a really important discovery, and in fact, it led to a very large experimental program that stretched all through the 1980s and 90s, and continues to this day. It led to the detailed verification of QCD as the correct theory of the internal structure. And extremely important, and it was based on very high energy accelerator experiments where you would have very high energy collisions so you could have high momentum transfers. But despite this success, this standard technology really, or this observation of asymptotic freedom, really doesn't help you analyze the internal structure of a proton or understand why its mass is what it is, why its radius is what it is at all. And the problem is that the quarks inside a proton actually have rather low energies, and therefore their effective coupling is in fact quite large. And QCD in this low energy regime, which is relevant to the structure of these guys, is very definitely non-perturbative. So very strongly coupled, very nonlinear theory. Theoretical physics does not have a whole lot of tools for dealing with a situation like that. It didn't then, it still actually doesn't now. But it was clear that in order to really get into one of the most fundamental issues around QCD, which is just how are the quarks put together to make matter, one needed something, some other technology. And that other technology, at least right now, is lattice QCD. And that's what I want to talk about. The lattice approximation, I'll tell you just a little bit about it, is really very simple-minded. The basic approximation just involves replacing continuous space and time by a grid. So it's the standard move that you'll make when you're solving differential equations or partial differential equations. Completely standard move that you make in solving classical field theories. Here we're doing it for quantum field theory. Basically, the fields that define this theory, the quark field, the gluon vector potential, and so on, rather than specifying these fields at every point in space and time, we only specify their values at the grid sites, at these points here. And if you need to know what the value of one of these fields is in between, you interpolate. Okay, so it's, again, very standard numerical move. Ken Wilson was the great pioneer of this back within 6 months, actually, of the discovery of asymptotic freedom. Wilson was already talking about this. So that's the basic approximation. If you apply that approximation to the path integral and QCD, the quantum mechanics of QCD is completely specified by a path integral formalism. What you discover is that the path integral becomes an ordinary multidimensional integral, where you're integrating, you know, as in just regular calculus, where you're integrating, your integration variables are the values of the fields at the various grid sites. So for every grid site, you have a field, and your integration value is the variable is the value of that field at that site. You just integrate over all values from minus infinity to plus infinity that that field can have. So by going to this space-time grid, you turn the quantum chromodynamics, this very relativistic quantum field theory, solving it into a problem of calculus, basically. You just have to do a multidimensional integral. Now, it's not just any old multidimensional integral. The problem, of course, is that the number of integration variables is related to the number of sites. And so you actually, in real work, have millions of integration variables that you have to do. So it's a sort of multi-million dimensional integral and of an incredibly peaky function, as it turns out. So one needs special numerical techniques, and we tend to use numerical Monte Carlo integration. I'm not going to say anything about these techniques. They're standard techniques, and I'd be happy to tell you about them later. We don't need them for this discussion. The main thing is to realize, though, is that the thing we are doing in our computer is evaluating the path integral in this lattice approximation. So it's evaluating a multidimensional integral, and we're evaluating it numerically. And that's the basic thing that you do in lattice QCD. Now, this subject, as I say, was invented in 1974, within 6 months of QCD sort of coming on people's radar screens in a way that couldn't be escaped. And it immediately had a success. One of the big mysteries about quarks in, say, 1970 was the fact that you couldn't see them experimentally. You could never get one quark. You'd smash protons together, and you know, protons would come out, or pi mesons, but you'd never get quark fragments flying out. And people began to conjecture that maybe the quarks couldn't be ripped out, that the forces between them were so strong that you couldn't isolate a single quark. One of the great triumphs of lattice QCD, right at the beginning, was that it actually gave a theoretical model. There was a limit of lattice QCD where confinement actually came out. And so it actually gave a rigorous model for how confinement works. That was a very, very impressive start, and it's what made a lot of people take lattice QCD seriously. Problem is that the subject then stalled for almost 20 years, and it stalled in the sense that the field very quickly became numerical. We have to run it on computers to do this path integral. And people spent a large part of that 20 years generating results that were of no interest whatsoever to anyone other than a lattice theorist. There was a lot of work done and a lot of progress, but the results were so inaccurate that they really were not relevant to anyone outside of the lattice QCD community. And in fact, it stalled so completely that Ken Wilson, now a Nobel laureate, at an international meeting in 1986 of lattice theorists, got up and to their, I guess, astonishment, just declared the field dead. He said, "Why are you working on this? This is hopeless. I'm going to go work on quantum chemistry." And he was, of course, the creator of the field, and as I said, by this time, a Nobel laureate. Of course, when a great man like this makes a really strong declaration like this, you expect the gods will punish him. And immediately, there was a renaissance in the 1990s, where the whole series of technical problems were fixed. And this took basically the whole of the 1990s. Huge advances were made. Wilson was absolutely right. The thing was completely solved there. But these technical breakthroughs, starting in the very early 90s, actually started to remove the problems one by one. And until we were at the position in 2000, 2001, where we actually had a working theory that was producing high precision results. In fact, the improvement was significant, sufficiently significant, that Ken Wilson actually retracted this statement in 1995, which was nice of him.
Is he still doing quantum chemistry?
He did that for several years. I don't think he's doing too much right now. He's really working a lot on K through 12 education, actually. We could discuss it at dinner. Two things in this list that I want you to pay attention to is larger lattice spacings became possible, and this thing called unquenching. And in fact, those are the two key breakthroughs that were made, one in the early 90s and one right in around 2000. And I'm going to discuss these in detail, but a key issue was, in fact, the size of this grid spacing. Before 1992, people were writing proposals saying that the grid spacing had to be smaller than a 20th of a Fermi. That's actually curious if you're a numerical person, because you're studying protons that have a like a Fermi across. You'd think you could do a pretty accurate result with a grid spacing of a quarter of a Fermi or half a Fermi. Going down to a 20th of a Fermi seems like overkill, but that's what people thought at that time, and I'll tell you why. Now we know that lattice spacings as large as 0.4 Fermi actually work quite well, and since the simulation cost goes like one over the lattice spacing to the sixth power, increasing the lattice spacing from something like a 20th to 0.1 or 0.4 can actually reduce the cost by hundreds or even millions. And so it had a huge impact on the cost of the simulations when we figured out how to get the lattice spacings to be much larger. The second breakthrough that I need you to keep in mind or think about as we go forward has to do with the quark masses. Two of the quarks, and there are, of course, six quarks in nature. Two of them, the U and the B quark, are very light compared to the proton. And it was very expensive to simulate U and B quarks with their correct mass. And in particular, up until about 2000, you generally simulated with masses that were 10 to 20 times too large. And even then, it was almost impossible to generate things like quark vacuum polarization. Very, very expensive. Because of a breakthrough in the way we simulate quark masses, we now have much smaller masses since 2000, and we're actually able not to simulate quite realistic masses, but we're close enough that we can actually extrapolate real QCD. And in particular, we can include accurate vacuum polarization. And it was vacuum polarization enters at the sort of 20-30% level. Until we were able to get small quark masses, we had 10 to 30% errors in our simulations that we simply couldn't get rid of. The fact that we've mastered that now means that high precision is possible for the first time. So what I want to talk about today is a little bit, give you a little bit of background on exactly what happened, what changed in our thinking about these theories, especially around these two breakthroughs, and then give you a status report on where we are today, in a sense of what we can actually calculate, and also at the very end, what we can't calculate. So to understand these breakthroughs, and in fact understand why this has taken 30 years to kind of get to the answer, we need to understand a little bit about how quantum field theory works on a lattice. And really what we're interested in is the precision of the simulation. What was wrong for most of those 30 years is the errors were plus or minus 50%, which is not much use. What is remarkable now is the errors are more like plus or minus 1%, which starts to be extremely useful. So what's changed? In order to understand that, you have to understand what the errors are due to. What are the approximations that we're making when we put a quantum field theory on the lattice? Well, one thing we're doing is we have to replace the derivatives. Quantum QCD is a field theory, so it's full of derivatives. Those derivatives have to be replaced by difference operators because we only know the fields on the grid sites. We don't know them in between. And so everywhere we have a derivative, you need to express it in terms of the fields whose values you know, so fields that are sitting on the grid somewhere. So if you want the derivative at some grid site xj, you can use the adjacent values divided by 2a to get an approximation to the derivative in an obvious fashion, right? This is a completely standard numerical analysis approximation. What you're doing is approximating this by something that only involves size of the grid sites. Now, you want high precision. You want to use big grid spacings because it costs a fortune if you use small ones because of the 1 over 8 to the 6. If you want to use large lattice spacings, you don't use such a simple approximation. Anyone who has done much of any numerical analysis knows that there are more accurate approximations to derivatives than just a simple standard difference. And numerical analysts tell you that you should use these approximations because they allow you to use much larger grid spacings. So, for example, you could replace that difference operator that I gave you on the previous page by the same operator, but now with a little correction that involves that operator Q acting on the field. This is a little correction, but it actually dramatically reduces the errors. And you can test and see how much by taking some standard function. Think of a function that's like a Fermi Y, and evaluate its exact derivative. Do this in Mathematica, for example. And then just look at the approximation. See how accurate this is. And pick a grid spacing like 0.4 Fermi, for example. And if you did that, you'd discover that this thing is accurate to the sort of 10 to 15% level. But if you include these two guys together, you start to get precision, even with a 0.4 Fermi lattice spacing of 1 to 2%. That's for studying something that's, say, one Fermi across. So the lattice spacing here is sort of half the radius of your wave function. So if you're interested in 1 to 2% precision, actually, this is accurate enough. You don't even need a highly improved derivative. That would be great. And in fact, if this was all there was to life, we would have been simulating with 0.4 Fermi 30 years ago. The problem, however, is that quantum numerical analysis and classical numerical analysis are not the same. This relationship is not quite correct, as it turns out, and the problem has to do with the other thing that the grid does in a quantum field theory. When you're on a grid, there's a smallest wavelength that you can simulate, and that way, smallest wavelength is 2 times the grid spacing. So there's a function that has that wavelength, just something that oscillates inside. So the wavelength is obviously 2a here. What you're modeling are fields, and these fields describe quarks and gluons. The wavelengths in those fields are related to the momenta of the quarks and gluons by this relationship. And so if there's a smallest wavelength, that means there's a largest momentum that you can simulate on your lattice, and that momentum is pi over the lattice spacing. So any quark or gluon state that has momentum bigger than pi over a is excluded by the grid. And so actually the grid is acting as an ultraviolet regulator or field theorists will recognize that it's just acting as an ultraviolet regulator. So an important part of the grid is that it's excluding these quark and gluon states, and that is problematic in quantum field theory because the very high momentum states actually affect the low momentum states. It's a very nonlinear theory, and in fact, they affect it very strongly. That's where the famous ultraviolet divergences of quantum field theory come from. That actually suggests that the high momentum states have an infinite effect on low momentum physics, which of course is misleading. So because of the nonlinearities in quantum field theory, all the momenta are actually important, and you can't simply throw out high momentum quarks and gluons because they do interact with quantum fluctuations. They will affect low momentum things. However, we're saved by your normalization theory, which tells us that we can mimic the effects of the high momentum stuff that we've excluded by adding extra pieces to our Lagrangian and to all the operators in the quantum field theory. These will be A-dependent pieces, but they'll be local, extra local interactions, so things at a point. And they have to be added to the field equations, the Lagrangian currents, every quantum mechanical operator you can simulate, you can mimic the effects of the stuff you left out by adding these correction terms. Now this complicates the analysis I gave you of the derivative, where I was trying to add in little a squared corrections here. And the problem is that you now get, these are local things. These are local corrections to that. And the problem is that the local corrections actually have two sources. One, so if you look at the coefficient, say, of this one, what I wrote two slides ago for that coefficient was minus a sixth. And that's what you get from classical numerical analysis. There is, however, another piece, another contribution to this coefficient that comes from the fact that you've excluded pi over a and higher momenta from the theory. So you've excluded quarks and gluons with these momenta. And you need this extra contribution in order to accurately simulate the effects of that physics. So the actual coefficient that goes in here should not be minus a sixth, it's something else. The problem is that this extra piece is very theory and context specific. You can't just look it up in a numerical analysis book. It depends on whether you're looking at QED, QCD, quantum gravity, highly non-universal. Depends on which term in the Lagrangian you're looking at, or whether you're looking at a current or something else. So this is actually bad news, because we need these a squared corrections in order to have large lattice spacings and to be able to afford the calculation. But your favorite numerical analysis book, which in my case is Numerical Recipes because my neighbor wrote it, it won't tell you the values of CA that you should use in your corrected difference operator. So the coefficients that come into your corrections are not part of classical numerical analysis. So that's the bad news. You need to know this C of A in order to actually simulate at large A. The good news is that physics from high momentum, momentum bigger than pi over A, will be perturbative if A is small enough because of asymptotic freedom. QCD at very short distances becomes perturbative. And so as long as A is small enough, all of this stuff that we threw out of the theory by putting it on lattice will actually become perturbative, which means we can actually calculate this coefficient using perturbation theory. And that's fabulous, because it means the perturbation theory fills the gaps in the lattice. And we can get the continuum results, or the results of the real world, without taking A to zero and without suffering the 1 over 8 of the 6th catastrophe. That was a big part of delaying the theory for years. And so, it, just to illustrate the kind of structure of things, if you look at a lattice Lagrangian, it might look something like this. If you're looking at a quark field, you'll have a Dirac operator, for example. This would be a difference approximation to the derivative. You'd have an a squared correction to it. You'd have some coefficient. That coefficient would have the classical piece in it, but then it would have corrections that are calculated in perturbation theory, which means you can expand them in powers of this QCD fine structure constant of the quark charge. And it's the fine structure constant, which is, remember, it's a running coupling constant, but it'll be evaluated at a scale of order pi over a, and if a is small enough, alpha will be small enough, and this will be a convergent series. And so we can actually use Feynman diagrams to calculate this stuff. And this stuff is, again, what mimics the quarks and gluons that have been excluded by the grid. So we have a prescription for actually calculating the C's, a rigorous way of doing it. So what emerges from this really tells you what the fundamental strategy is in lattice QCD. And in fact, it's useful to think about how we're tackling the theory. Asymptotic freedom tells us that QCD actually has sort of two components. The short distance part of QCD is simple. It's perturbative. You can use Feynman diagrams to study it. The long distance physics, however, is difficult. It's non-perturbative. You need Monte Carlo. You need some other technique. What the lattice is doing is it's separating the short from the long. The momentum bigger than pi over a QCD, that's the short distance part. This we can analyze and completely using Feynman diagrams. And we use those things to calculate corrections to the Lagrangian and to everything else in the theory. And we compute them in perturbation theory. And in fact, the thing that determines the lattice spacing, as you'll see in a minute, is in fact this step. It's whether perturbation theory converges or not for the lattice spacing you've picked. Once you've dealt with this part of QCD by calculating these corrections, which you then add to your Lagrangian, you then go and solve the low momentum part of QCD using numerical Monte Carlo integration. It would be insane to use this kind of technology to solve physics that you can solve with perturbation theory. This is incredibly expensive, requires vast, you know, multi-hundred processor computers and so on to solve. You really want to only use those computers for solving the parts of the theory where there is no other way. And so you really want to pick your lattice spacing so that you really get it right between the perturbative and non-perturbative part. And that's what we do today. So that's the general strategy. High momentum part, analyzed perturbatively, expressed as corrections, which we then stick into our non-perturbative simulation, which will then give the right answer because we've added in the high momentum part through the corrections. Corrections calculated in perturbation theory. Now, this idea of improved discretizations, which is critical to get the lattice spacing big, and was an essential part of the first major breakthrough, is actually an old idea. It was something that Wilson was aware of, you know, in the 70s, from day one. The problem is that perturbation theory is essential here, and it's absolutely critical that the lattice spacing be small enough so that momenta of order pi over a are perturbative. And so QCD becomes perturbative for high enough momentum, but you have to get to a momentum where it is high enough. And in 1992, or before 1992, it looked like you had to go to fantastically small lattice spacings in order for that to be the case. What was discovered in 1992 was a technical error in the way they did perturbation theory. And that suggested that you could actually work at 10 times larger lattice spacings and still have perturbation theory work. It's very easy to test something like this, by the way. You know that short distance quantities can be analyzed using perturbation theory, but we can also compute them using our numerical Monte Carlo integration just on the computer. And that actually gives the exact result. And so what you can do is calculate things in perturbation theory, calculate them on your computer, you know, with Feynman diagrams, and calculate them on your computer with path integral integration, and then compare and just see whether perturbation theory is working or not. And all you need are some convenient short distance quantities for which you can calculate the perturbation theory. One thing that's really convenient to use, I think, are Wilson loops, which are involve loop integrals of the vector potential around closed paths. And you exponentiate it, do a few other things to it. But basically, you're integrating the QCD vector potential around a closed path and then taking the vacuum expectation value of it. If you make the path small enough, then it will be perturbative. A very big path, like two Fermis, and it won't be perturbative. So you can actually vary the path size and just ask, does perturbation theory for this agree with what you get from Monte Carlo? And I'll show you some data from 1992. The round circles are what you get from the Monte Carlo integration for different loop sizes. And we're looking here at a funny ratio of loops called a Kreis ratio. But basically, it's just those loops. And this is what, these are the exact answers, the circles. The errors are insignificant here. The dashed line is what you get from what I call old perturbation theory. It's the perturbation theory that people were using up until 1992. And you'll see out here at half a Fermi, or above 0.1 Fermi, it's a disaster. You're off by a factor of 4 from the right answer. And even if you go to second order, you're still off by more than a factor of 2 from the right answer. The technical problem, once it was identified, and I'll be happy to tell you about it later, totally changed the situation. And you see here the perturbative results work incredibly well, even out to 0.2, 0.3 Fermi. And of course, when you go to second order, the line goes right through the middle of the circles until you get the very, very large lattice spacings. So it was really perturbation theory that was holding us back and preventing us from implementing the Aisberg corrections, what people were doing was when they used this perturbation theory, they actually dramatically underestimated the corrections from perturbation theory. This is a good example of dramatically underestimating something. And so they never put in enough Aisberg correction to actually make things work. An important question is, I've now established the perturbation theory works out to half of Fermi. Does this whole improved discretization business actually work? How do we know that we have correct answers? And let me just give you one very quick example of the kinds of things we do. If you look at the standard discretization. This was the standard discretization before 2000, the year 2000, of the quark action had a squared errors. And in fact, if you did a sort of low momentum expansion of that standard discretization, you'd see that the a squared errors looked something like this. They behave something like this. So you have the Dirac theory, but then you have this extra piece that had three derivatives. This is a gauge covariant derivative. Three derivatives times gamma mu and an a squared in it. And a term like this, is the kind of thing that we want to add corrections to the Lagrangian to get rid of. We want to add a correction to get rid of something like that. You'll notice that this error in the theory actually breaks rotation and Lorentz invariants, Poincaré invariants, because you've got four Lorentz indices underneath this sum. So it's neither rotation nor Poincaré invariant. And that actually gives you a clue as to how you might test whether your improved theory actually is improved. You can look to see whether Poincaré invariance is improved. So how do you test Poincaré invariance? Well, one thing you can do is you can calculate the energy, say, of a pion or a proton, something like that, in your simulation. Take square the energy, subtract the mass of that particle, and divide it by the three momentum squared. This quantity, if you have Lorentz invariance, should be independent of p. It should be the speed of light, right? Which, because I'm a theorist, is equal to 1. So this quantity, if you have Lorentz invariance, should be completely p independent, and it should be equal to 1. So you go, you do your simulation with pions, you take an uncorrected action and just calculate what c squared is, and well, it's not constant, but the really dramatic thing for this then standard theory, this is 1997, was that it wasn't anywhere near 1. It was off by 40%. But you add just the first level of improvement, the a squared improvement, and the results are all up clustered around 1. Very high momentum, eventually it breaks down, but much, 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 I mean, dramatically improved. You're going from 40% errors to 5-7% errors in this simulation. This is a 0.25 Fermi lattice spacing. So tests like that tell you right away that you've done it. And it's important to realize that the improved theory here has no free parameters in it. The coefficients come from perturbation theory. You just put in whatever you get, and then you go and run the simulation and hope that it ends up there and not down there, and that's what it did. Today, actually, I'll show you something from a paper that will be out in a couple of weeks. This is, again, c squared, and I just wanted to show that we actually have much higher standards today, 10 years later. Here, this is 1 point, well, this is 10% error here. These c's are within 1 to 2% of the right value, and we're measuring them incredibly accurately now. And in fact, even this is a little troubling to me. It's a little higher than it should be, and it's because of a small tuning error we made in the simulation, which we've actually corrected now. But we are much, much more serious about this now. And in fact, this is for an A to C, which is a meson made of charm quarks, very, very heavy charm quarks, actually. The mass is almost equal to the inverse lattice spacing, which should mean that we are very, very challenged with a large mass like that, but it's still working incredibly well. So that's larger lattice spacings. I could show you dozens of examples of larger lattice spacings making things better. But that's the 1980 story. I want now to shift to this thing called unquenching in the quark masses, the second issue. All through the 1990s, lattice QCD people would publish results and say, this is the result of quenched QCD. And What did they mean by quench QCD? What they meant was QCD without quark vacuum polarization, right? Without quark loops, the phenomenon where gluons can create quark anti-quark pairs temporarily, and then have them annihilate again back into gluons. And the reason we did this is we simply could not afford to put in quark vacuum polarization back in the 1990s because the algorithms we had here were just too slow. The problem is that quark vacuum polarization is important at this sort of 20-30% level. You need it, and if you leave it out, then your answer's going to be wrong, and you never knew whether it was wrong by +20% or -20%, and this wasn't all that good for a high-precision thing that is costing a fortune because you're on the world's largest computer. This really was the major limitation for Lattice QCD. This was the brick wall that we couldn't breach until 2000. And what happened in 2000 was a different discretization strategy was adopted for the light quarks. And the problem is the light quarks, the U and D quarks. And what people did was revive old discretization that had been more or less abandoned by the field, but improved it, added in the A squared corrections, and discovered that in fact the resulting formalism was incredibly accurate, but it was also vastly faster than the existing algorithms at that time. And it sort of depends on who you ask, whether it was 50 or 1,000. But it doesn't matter because the relevant fact is that in fact this new formalism, vastly faster and particularly effective in the chiral limit, which means the small quark mass limit, immediately made it feasible to do realistic simulations of QCD, including the vacuum polarization, using today's computers. For most of Lattice QCD's history, the theorists would say, give me a computer that's 5 times bigger than the ones we have today, and I will solve the theory. And of course, the computer industry obliged, right? Every 36 months, they have one that was still 4 times faster, and it wouldn't work. The problem is you only get factors of 2 and, from computer advances. These algorithmic advances give factors like 100 or 1,000, which take decades to get in hardware. It really needed smarter ways of approaching the quantum numerical analysis. So as a result of this breakthrough, very, very quickly we're in a position of being able to do very realistic simulations. There's a collaboration, a Lattice collaboration in the States that called the Milk Collaboration that generated a huge amount of stuff that many other collaborations got to use, including mine. And it allowed us to really enter a completely new era of Lattice QCD simulations where we had small quark masses, realistic vacuum polarization, and as a result, very, very high precision. So how do I know that we had very high precision? How do you check something like this? I can remember in 2000, suddenly realizing that this new technology would in fact deliver what we had been looking for in this field for years. And I had been in and out of the field for years because it really was stuck and then unstuck and stuck. But in 2000, it looked like we'd actually finally arrived. And I can remember calling up some of my colleagues, like Christine Davis, for example, Howard Trottier and Simon Fraser, and calling up my colleagues and saying, well, you know, what do we do now? We're there. What are the big problems? And of course, one of the first problems was to convince ourselves that the thing was actually working at the 1-2% level. If you have a theory that has never been able to do better than 30% errors, ±30%, if you start publishing papers claiming that your answers are accurate to 1%, especially if it's on new physics, you're going to have a problem with your credibility. And so a very important part of this, we decided very early on, was that we had to do some really non-trivial testing to convince ourselves and others that we really were in this totally new universe. So, in the end, four pretty substantial collaborations got together and pooled resources and did a fairly serious test. And what did we do? Well, the simulation actually only has five free parameters. And those are the five parameters of QCD. It's the quark masses. We set the U and V quark masses equal. That's an approximation, but only a 1% type error from that. It's the UV mass, the strange mass, the charm mass, the B mass, and the coupling constant. These are all bare parameters in the Lagrangian, and they're the same parameters you have in regular QCD. Those are the only parameters in the theory, and what we did is we picked five incredibly well-measured quantities and used them to tune these parameters perfectly. So we found what the bare up quark mass was, what the bare strange quark mass was. We adjusted them to make the pion mass, the kaon mass, the psi mass. These are various mesons. Come out exactly right. Having done that, there are no more free parameters in the simulation. In fact, there's nothing else you can tune. You just calculate lots of other things and see whether they agree with the experiment. And you pick things that you can calculate very, very effectively and efficiently, very accurately, and you, but also things that have been measured very, very accurately, so there's no ambiguity about your results. And so you generate these new things with no free parameters, and you form the ratio of the lattice QCD result divided by experiment. Now, the right answer for this, of course, is 1, if you've got things nailed. And you just do a whole bunch of different things to test a whole bunch of different aspects of the theory, different things chosen for different reasons. There are about, I think, 14 now. When we wrote the paper, there were 9. We keep adding to this as time goes on. And they involve things like the decay rate of the pi and the k, mass differences between various baryons and the mass of a baryon, mass differences between heavy quark mesons and so on. So it's a lot of different things, but again, lots of things, no free parameters. In fact, each of these is an independent calculation. In fact, when we were doing them, they were being done mostly by different people, none of whom actually knew what this ratio was going to be, because there was one piece to the analysis they couldn't put in. So it was actually a blind analysis. And they would send me the result, and I would convert it, put in the last factor, and put it on this plot, and this is what came out. What you're seeing here are results, lattice QCD agreeing with experiment, to within that sort of 1.5% error on that there. Those are the smallest errors. These are 3% errors. That's maybe a 4 or 4.5% error there. But spectacular agreement here with full QCD, with the vacuum polarization, realistic vacuum polarization in place. If you leave out the vacuum polarization, you get a picture like this, where some things are 15% too high, other things are 8% too low. There are other ones, actually, that are infinitely far away because they don't exist when you leave out vacuum polarization. But it's a big mess. This is what we were dealing with in the 1990s. Would be, some things would be positive, some things would be negative, no real pattern. This is what we have now. This is probably the most accurate strong interaction calculation ever done, certainly from fundamental principles. I hate showing this plot in some sense because a huge amount of work went into each one of these points, and it just to show it in one slide is slightly misleading, and I'll show you just 2 examples of things that went into that slide to give you a sense of just how many calculations are involved and how much stuff was checked. Yeah.
That current what was just an quenched calculation, or was unquenched without?
I'm sorry, this one?
Let's go.
This is no vacuum polarization. Quenched.
Okay.
And we just gathered old results, or redid some results in order to make the comparison. We're trying to get a sense of just how important is vacuum polarization, and it is important. You know, this to that is like 20, almost 30%.
And I mean, for each of these ones, you can say, I mean, why you get the large, F5 gets large.
No one can explain the pattern. That was the problem. If we could have explained this pattern ahead of time, we wouldn't need this calculation. But no one knew whether F5 was high or low. And so we were always forced to quote 20 or 30% errors because we had very little way of estimating the impact of vacuum polarization back then. We tried. There were a couple of cases where you could do it, but by and large, you couldn't.
How did you know it was 20 to 30% that you couldn't calculate?
Hand waving. You do it from, you know, the row is stapled if you don't have vacuum polarization. The row mass on, but its width is like 20% of its mass. And so it would be that kind of argument. And
can you?
And you look, you know, you can look at a plot like this and see that it's, well, you know, there's 15% minus 90%.
Yeah.
So we could do that in the 1990s, and that's what was happening. And it was causing great confusion because people would tune things in different ways and stuff would be all over the map. So it was really very, very hard to do. It was impossible to do precision phenomenology then because of this squishiness which is captured in this plot. Yeah.
Can you compute the quantum mass and neutron mass and do both?
Yeah, because they're not as accurate. At the time I made these plots, we weren't doing them as accurately as say the omega mass. And for this, I wanted the most accurate thing. But the proton works just fine. The neutron works fine within the errors. Probably the errors now are around 5% because no one's working that hard on it because no one cares that much about the proton mass. What we're really interested in are the mesons, as I'll tell you. Right now and there, their masses are coming out to within a percent.
Sensitivity on the UMD mass, suppose you put them to zero when you compute the proton mass, how much does it change?
No, you tune them to the right value. Well, we can't get right to the right value, but we can get within a factor of two. And then you use, and that's what I was going to show on this plot here. Here's an example of one of the calculations. This is calculating the pion and kaon decay constants. And this is the data that were used to make those entries in that plot. And what I'm plotting down here is the valence UD mass divided by the strange mass. And the correct value for that is down here. That ratio should be 1/25, roughly. We could only get this close. Now, actually, we're a good deal closer now. We can get in around here now. But we're close enough that, in fact, the extrapolation is only 9% or something for f pi and just a couple percent for f k. And so chiral perturbation theory, which is the theory of the mass dependence of physical quantities, chiral perturbation theory can be used to extrapolate down here and you get results. Obviously, even if you take a ruler and just draw a straight line, you're obviously going to get something that's within a percent of the right answer from this. In fact, we do a pretty sophisticated chiral perturbation theory analysis. These little points here, these fly specks are data, Monte Carlo data from the path integral. And we fit chiral perturbation theory to those data and then extrapolate down here and get a point about there. This is the real pion mass. And the real f pi, rather. And this is extremely reliable. You'll see, though, if I add in high mass points, you'll see that the curve that actually works down here fails at high masses. And the problem we had up until 2000 is that the only masses we had were on that side of the hockey stick. And so you have to extrapolate from those two points up there, and you would end up 20% off if you did it. The mass extrapolations that we do, they require the mass to be sufficiently small. The masses we could reach before 2000 were not sufficiently small for chiral perturbation theory to work. So we discard all of these masses now and just use the low masses. And it's completely predictable. I mean, everyone knew in the 1990s that these masses were too big. And there was no question about it. We just didn't know what to do about it. But now we know what to do about it. Another example analysis, I showed a mass splitting between a psi meson and an eta c, or between a d star meson and a d meson, or d sub s. These are, again, no free parameters in these plots. What we're doing here are, this is give you a sense of the kinds of things we have to do to get high precision. Here are two different simulations with two different discretizations of the quark action, the charm quark action. One is the one that is now very widely used and was the breakthrough formalism. This is one we developed very, very recently. In fact, this is the paper that's about to come out in a couple of weeks. specifically to work, especially to work with charm quarks, which we need in order to do deep physics. And we were dealing with the fact that, in these formalisms, there are multiple ways of calculating mesons, it turns out, and you don't trust the formalism unless different ways agree with each other. And the problem we were having with the old formalism is that you get very, very big disagreements relative to experiment and relative to each other when you did them different ways, but with this very highly improved thing, those have been crushed down now to the level where they're just a few MeV. And so the uncertainties here are just a few MeV out of 3 GeV. And this thing, and you see exactly the same thing over here with the D's. Again, another thing we will do, in addition to comparing different formalisms, different discretizations, is you compare different lattice spacings, and you're looking to see that you get the same results as you vary the grid spacing, showing that you have the A squared errors under control. So, another quantity, which I'll just show you very briefly, is the QCD coupling. That was one of the parameters we tuned. That's something that's measured by lots of methods that do not involve lattice QCD, high energy collisions. It's something that the particle physics community has spent a fortune measuring over the last 30 years. We can measure it in our simulation because once we tuned everything, our simulation really is lattice QCD. And so we can find all sorts of short distance quantities, invent short distance quantities, things that have perturbative expansions. We can calculate the values of those things using Monte Carlo integration and then fit this formula to that to get a value for alpha. And we did that for a whole bunch of different things, both with vacuum polarization and without, and it actually came up with incredibly accurate values. Here are all the different values of the coupling constant that we got, all 28. You see, they all agree with each other to within errors. There are obvious correlations in here. These are not statistically independent. There are systematic effects that we understand. But over these 28 different quantities, which is like 28 different measurements, we get tremendous consistency. And if you compare it, this is the result from that analysis, with what you get from high energy experiments, from very high energy collisions, the thing that is really impressive is that this thing from lattice QCD agrees with all of these other ones to within everyone's errors. It also has smaller error bars than all the other ones, and that's just the way it's going to be forever, actually, because this is easier to do experimentally. Now that the theory is caught up, it'll be almost impossible to match this precision of any of these
methods. Are those one sigma errors? Is those one sigma errors on the experiment?
This picture is from the particle data book, and that was the world average.
Like 1 sigma or 2 sigma?
It's two. There's the world average right there, so it's 2 sigma. And that average did not include our point. This is the 2004 average. It's interesting to remove the vacuum polarization and see what happens. It moves here. The vacuum polarization is incredibly important. The light port vacuum polarization. You can start to go back and forth. This again is the result of 28 different measurements. It's not just one measurement. So actually, we did as many things as there are up there. We just didn't do the things that other people do. The thing that these agree, and it's actually from a conceptual point of view very, very important, because the things that go in here are all perturbative. It's all high energy QCD. The stuff that we're doing down here has to do with the masses of mesons and so on. It's all non-perturbative QCD. And what this plot is showing is that the QCD of high energy jets and gluon jets and so on is in fact the same QCD as the QCD of confinement of meson structure. Because this is spectacularly non-perturbative in an essential way. These are completely perturbative. And so that's very, very reassuring. Yeah.
Kind of my question.
Sure.
It's about how you define the coupling constant when you are in lattice QCD. Is that a property? Because you have access only to gauge invariant operators.
No, you can actually calculate gauge non-invariant operators if you want. You can gauge this.
Okay, so there's no subtlety in how you define that.
You can relate any definition of the coupling constant to any other using perturbation theory, actually. One of the actually in 1992, the critical breakthrough was or half of it, was realizing that you should not use a funny lattice-specific definition, but you should use alpha MSR like everyone else does. That turned out to be a critically important observation. In a lot of our stuff, we actually use a standard continuum definition of the coupling constant for our analysis. I don't like alpha MSR, but you could have done it without alpha MSR.
But you know how to go from that scheme to the left scheme. So you have to
And the way you do it is the way you match schemes in the continuum, which is you calculate some quantity and just require that the two schemes give the same answer ordered by order in perturbation theory. Whether or not that quantity can be analyzed perturbatively is irrelevant. We're just trying to match the couplings. And we can do the same thing here. You calculate physical quantities. For example, you could use a coupling constant defined by the static port potential. That's something you can calculate in the continuum. You can certainly calculate it on the lattice with perturbation theory, and that allows us to actually relate the coupling constant, lattice coupling constants, to the continuum coupling constants, out to fourth order, and third order perturbation theory.
Is it understood why the epsilon decay is off?
Yeah. Actually, that's my calculation from years ago with Paul McKenzie in the 80s. And I think it's because perturbation theory is not converging. This is one of these things that goes 1 minus 12 alpha over pi, and no one knows the second order piece. But I think it's because there's a very large second order piece that has not been accounted for. And it's interesting because we've done the positronium calculation to that order, and there is a biggish next order piece in positronium. So I think this is just not a good choice. The error bar reflects people's unease about the process, and so from a standard deviation, you know, if you take the error bar seriously, it's not in such terrible disagreement. Okay, let me end very, very quickly by telling you where this leaves us now. We have a few percent accuracy, and we can do dozens of what we call gold-plated things. These are things we can tackle right today, and are tackling right today, and measure to the few, 1-3% level. And it's masses and form factors of stable particles, mixing amplitudes for Bs and things like that. And just about all sorts of things for CC bar and PD bar, honestly, very massive mesons. And so we have, this is a program that we realized we had back in 2000, and we've been sort of systematically marching through this trove of things that we can calculate using today's technology. One of the main focus areas has been heavy quark physics. And that's because there's a huge experimental program here that desperately needs reliable, non-perturbative QCD. What people are doing is they're studying the radioactive decays of quarks, but the radioactive decays are studied not of the quarks, but of the mesons that contain them. And those mesons, everything that you measure always involves a weak interaction part, which is what you're trying to measure, but also a QCD part. And you need to calculate this in order to get rid of it so you can pull out the weak interaction part. And so we and our competitors have been putting a lot of effort into calculating masses, decay constants, mixing amplitudes, the sorts of things that are needed by the big experiments at SLAC, at KEK, Fermilab, and so on. Cranking them out. In fact, one of the main things that people focus on here is something called the CKM matrix element. And you're trying to measure the CKM matrix, all of these elements, and they're measured by processes like the ones I'm showing here. And these are the things, these are all things we can calculate to a percent on the lattice, and we're systematically working our way through the whole thing. When I say we, I mean the community. It's me and competing groups. The idea behind the experimental program is to push the standard model of particle physics to the point of failure. You're really trying to discover where the theory just falls apart.
Right now, what limits this? Say the checks and the sum of the entirety of the row.
Well, everything's limited by theory. And so it's our errors are the dominant errors in almost everything.
So how far are you from being able to actually have your errors small enough that you can actually make it?
We're the dominant. If you look up the Bisabes Mason paper that came out of Fermi Lab last year, the dominant error now is the lattice gauge theory error. In fact, it's our collaboration's paper. We figure that once we get down below about 3 or 4%, then the experimental errors will pretty much, actually that one has really tiny errors, but by and large, the experimental errors will have a hard time going much below a couple percent. And we think we can get down to a couple percent. We're not there yet. We finished the first pass through all of this, and we're down around 8-9%. The next pass, we know exactly what to do, should bring us below 3-4%. And I hope that we deliver on the deep physics by this summer. In fact, we're basically finished. We're sort of futzing with it right now. And then the B physics will be the next year or two, probably 2 years actually. It's always twice as long as you think. And so the B physics program is for me the heart of it because there's such a big community that needs it, but there's also interesting work being done on hadronic structure, things like structure functions, lots of work on finite temperature physics, although it's very, very hard to do finite density on the lattice, as I'll mention in a minute. And, of course, we got very powerful new technique for dealing with things non-perturbatively, and this is a rather new development in theoretical particle physics, and it may be a good thing because actually most of the interactions that we know today are in fact strongly coupled, probably. QCD, gravity probably, although we haven't sort of settled on what gravity is yet, but obviously it's not weakly coupled and we would have settled on it a long time ago. So it's pretty likely in most people's scenarios for LHC physics and beyond, there are non-perturbative sectors. And so one of the things that one thinks about more and more is strong coupling beyond just QCD. So just to end, we're at few percent precision now in lattice QCD. It provides a superb opportunity for lattice QCD to have an impact on particle physics. It's absolutely essential for B and B physics that's going on at big labs all over the place. And in fact, right now, we're kind of racing with those experiments to try and predict as many of their results as we can to try and give ourselves more credibility. Experimenters are always more impressed when you're number was in the paper months before their number came out. Of course, they may need credibility at some point, but given that the field has such large errors historically, it's rather important to worry about credibility. It's very important to have low mass vacuum polarization. The lattice QCD community does not entirely agree with what I'm presenting. It's a subset that does. There's another subset that doesn't like the quark discretizations that we're using. They present results, but their results never have low mass UV and S quarks, and you can't do phenomenology without low mass UV, especially UV quarks. So it's very important to keep that in mind when you're looking at other papers. I might also add that this is a landmark in the history of quantum field theory. We're really in an era now or a stage of doing the quantitative verification of a new non-perturbative technology. It's kind of like the 1950s were when perturbation theory or normalization theory was brand new. People spent hours measuring little tiny splittings between energy levels in atoms, and hours calculating two-loop Feynman diagrams to see whether this newfangled perturbation theory actually worked, Feynman perturbation theory actually worked. And by the end of the 1950s, we knew we had it nailed. We're kind of in that state right now with this new technology, but it is, in fact, non-perturbative quantum field theory. And the fact that we actually have it working in QCD ought to encourage us to start thinking more aggressively about things beyond QCD, getting ourselves ready for the future. So I'm going to end there. I will display on this Some things that we can't do with this technology, which is actually 90% or 95% of QCT, but what we can do is still very, very impressive. Thank you.
You mentioned lattice spacing. What did you say about the size the lattices are and the lattice points?
The volumes you want to have a volume at least 2.5 fermis on the side, maybe 3 fermis. And that corresponds to lattices that might be 20 to 30 points on a side. And it's 4 dimensions because it's space and time. So whatever 20 to the fourth is, that's how many points we're dealing with.
And what is in these lattices? Sorry for the naive question.
What is?
Like, what's the physical scenario that's being discretized? What kind of physical?
What kind of physical thing are we looking at? I mean, we'll look at how a pion decays. And it decays by its quark and anti-quark annihilating into a W. And so what you need is the wave function at the origin of the pion wave function evaluated with the quarks on top of each other. So we can use the path integral to calculate something like that. We'll look at a form factor. So you'll look at the scatter of a meson off of some external field, classical field or a current. And so you might scatter a proton off of an electric field and to determine its radius or something like that. There are a whole bunch of things like that. It's various sort of quantum mechanical quantities that we can link back to experiment. A lot of what we do to test is just calculating masses. This theory should predict the mass of a proton. It should predict the mass of a pi meson. So we measure masses of different mesons and baryons in order to see that they're actually agreeing, either agreeing with the experiment or to predict states that haven't been discovered yet. So it's decay rates, form factors, masses. There are some subtle phenomena in weak interactions where one type of K meson will turn into another type through very tiny interactions. And that kind of mixing amplitude, we can calculate those on the lattice and compare them with experiment. There are a lot of things that we can't calculate. I mean, a high energy collision of two hadrons, for example, is very hard to calculate on the lattice for technical reasons. And the way, you know, when you smash protons together, quarks and gluons come flying out and gradually turn into pions and protons and so on through very complicated interactions. And that process is called hadronization. And we can't analyze that on our lattice. The main reason is because in order to do these, to make the path integral of Elvin gaze, we can do it numerically. We had to make time imaginary. And we can analytically continue back to real time for a variety of quantities, but we have a real problem with anything that has very complicated temporal evolution. The sort of continuing it back part is almost impossible to do. And so things that have complicated final state phases or like hadronization, a very complicated sort of rearrangement of stuff, is hard to do unless you ask totally inclusive questions and then you can turn it back into things that are we can handle. But when you really need to know how that pion formed in the jet, that involves a very complicated space-time evolution that is so far away from the imaginary time that we're looking at that we just don't have anywhere near enough precision to get with. In fact, one of the things that I would say is these are very serious limitations, and it's because the approach that we have is a real meat axe approach to it. It's not a subtle, sophisticated, theoretical method. Very effective, it's already having a big impact on B and deep physics, but there are huge parts of QCD that you can't deal with this One of the things that we realized from these simulations that is different from the way people thought 30 years ago is that perturbation theory actually works out to fairly large distances, almost out to half Fermi. And we can check that by calculating the static potential as a function of R. And perturbation theory does a great job at half a Fermi. Now, proton has a radius of 0.8 or 0.9 Fermi. I mean, it's only a little bit bigger than that. And in fact, nothing happens in QCD at distances bigger than 1.5, 2 Fermis because of confinement. And so everything's perturbative up to half a Fermi. The only degrees of freedom that aren't perturbative and that matter are between half a Fermi and maybe 1.5 or something. So it's a lousy factor of 3 in scale. That's not a whole lot of degrees of freedom, actually. And when you think about that, you think there's got to be some other way of dealing with this. And it would be really nice if someone could start to explore some non-Monte Carlo alternatives. For example, as Wilson showed right at the beginning, if you go to very large distances, you can, where the coupling is big, you can do expansions in 1 over the coupling constant, strong coupling expansions. Those things break down at short distances, because the coupling gets small and 1 over g becomes a bad expansion parameter. But they, traditionally, people have been working down to a Fermi and maybe even below a Fermi. If they work all the way down to half a Fermi, then you have strong coupling down to half a Fermi, weak coupling from half a Fermi down. You could solve the theory. The way you do it is you would use perturbation theory to calculate the Lagrangian with a cutoff of half a Fermi, corrections to that Lagrangian, and then you would use strong coupling theory to solve the corrected theory, but with lattice spacing of half a Fermi. And the strong coupling would have all the short distance stuff from the corrections, but you would be using strong coupling rather than Monte Carlo to solve it. It would only work with really big lattice spacing, like half a Fermi. But if you could even get 10% accurate results from something like that, it would be a major breakthrough, because then you could start to think about things like hadronization and some, because you'd be having control at sort of the GDV level, which is where that sort of thing happens. And it would be really good to think about some other methods.
Lagrangian and duality.
Yes, yeah, all those things.
Can you press those a lot?
You can certainly do simulations at different ends. And people don't. I don't right now, because we're enjoying the feeding frenzy on stuff that's relevant to experiment. And it's very hard to get off on something like that, something speculative like that, if you don't have some part of the theory that's totally nailed down, where you're certain that it's working. And we weren't in that position until just a few years ago. And that's why now is actually a good time to start thinking about some of the other variational methods, other expansions like 1 over n and so on, and seeing if you can somehow use the simulation technology that we have, that does let you calculate a bunch of things, to provide fake data that you can then tune these other models on, and then actually come up with some sort of alternative expansion. Because one thing we do have now is simulations that are real, they're realistic, and they can generate all sorts of things. I mean, you ask for matrix elements of this or that, we can calculate a lot of them. And so we can generate pseudo data from the simulation that might be more relevant to the kinds of questions that you might be interested in if you were pursuing a Lagrangian expansion or something like that. And so if I wasn't having so much fun explaining experiment, I think I would might be flexing around with stuff like that. A lot of it is stuff that people tried 20 years ago and gave up on because it just sort of, they ran out of steam. And I'm not sure we've run out of steam now, because we actually have computational control of QCD in over a fairly broad range of limits. And so we can do a lot of stuff that we could do before and know that it's wrong.
So if you, I think if you do the renormalization group analysis for the coupling, for the strong coupling constant, but don't go to high momenta, but instead go to low momenta, I think it would blow up.
Yeah, this is
it. It would become infinite at about 400 MeV or so, based on a perturbation calculation, but that the foundation for such a perturbation calculation would, of course, break down when the coupling becomes big. So can you follow with your numerical simulations what happens with a coupling constant if you go to smaller momenta?
That actually is what this picture is. This is alpha as a function of V over A, which is the momentum, versus V over A. And we're down at lowest momenta are just below the GPV, and alpha's getting up around 0.8. When we were doing this, our analysis, we calculated many different quantities at many different scales. And as you can see, they actually fit nicely on a curve. The dashed line is, in fact, the three-loop perturbation theory prediction. So perturbation theory is working very, very well, all the way down to roughly alpha of 1, roughly. What happens below that is perturbation theory gets extremely murky. And the problem I have with what you just proposed is just the question of how you define alpha at very, very low momentum. Most definitions of alpha rely upon perturbation theory itself. And so you need some sort of non-perturbative definition of what you mean by alpha. And different non-perturbative definitions will give different behavior is the problem. They'll just be radically different. You won't be able to relate them in any simple way because you're non-perturbative. They're relatable at short high momentum, but non-relatable at low momentum. So as far as we've gone is basically almost to alpha equals 1. Perturbation theory is amazingly good when alpha is equal to 1. I would have never believed this when I used to do perturbative QCD, but it is. But much below that, we can't. So I can't address, for example, the models that some people have where they have the alpha sort of freeze out and becomes constant. That's not something that I don't know how to address that in a rigorous fashion because it depends upon what you mean by alpha at the very, very soft kind of. I don't know. Do you have a definition that you like?
No, I'm not part of the system anymore.
Yeah.
But I would suppose that around that scale where the coupling blows up, you also change the degrees of freedom. And then below that energy scale, you have composite degrees of freedom.
Now, when I was talking about the matching and so doing perturbation theory all the way up to half of Fermi and then using strong coupling or variational calculation, what I was wanting to do was use a completely different set of basis set than the perturbative set to try and analyze the theory at long distances, because it really is different degrees of freedom. The boundary between the perturbative regime and the non-perturbative regime is the place where this crosses 1, roughly. And so it's roughly there. Well, actually, you can see it looks like it's around half a GeV, actually. It's 500 MeV, which is about half of Fermi, actually.
That might be a good place to move the discussion into one-on-one vote. And Peter's here for the rest of the day. And we'll be
Thank you.